as well get going. And you got your quiz today. Try not to just be studying the whole time for the quiz while I go over other material. But I'm afraid if I give the quiz right now, right after the quiz, you're just going to split. So we'll give the quiz towards the end. But hopefully you'll be able to pay attention somewhat in the meantime. Yes? Okay, so what's happening next week, Monday? We're going to lab, right? And we're going to review. And that lab section, you know, you got your whole 3 hours. We probably won't use the whole 3 hours, but what we're going to do is to maybe wrap up a little bit more on circulatory system, you know, so there's going to be some content in there. I'll try to record that on Echo 360, and of course then we have the 4 lab sections, so I'm going to repeat everything. And then we're going to have a review session. Now what's this review for? The exam on Thursday, right? And then the Wednesday group will also have a review, so everybody's got the review before the class. If any of you want to come to the Monday, it doesn't matter, we can cram in, and you can kind of mix around this week, because we're not doing wet labs. So you can look at any of those sections and come to any of those. And for some people, 4 people are going to NCR. Those people can come on the Monday and get everything, but if it's on Echo too, I'll post that. So Monday's lab and Wednesday's lab, you will get content for the class and review. So what does that mean this weekend? What are we doing? Studying and getting all your questions together, right? So then it's your time to ask questions, go over old exams. We've had a number of questions on the old exams. Remember, I mentioned before, we put all those old exams up, but those old exams come from multiple instructors over the years. I mean, those go back, you know, some 10 years. We had an instructor before that was very good. It was Brent Palmer. He was a reproductive endocrinologist, and there's some of those reproductive hormones and pathways were much more in-depth than what we covered here, because he emphasized a lot of that. He cut the neuro short, so we always kind of, I don't know, arm wrestling back and forth with that. And so some of those questions are way too much in depth than what we're going to cover in here. So if you have questions on those, I suggest you look over the old exams, multiple ones, right, and the ones posted on your website, and the ones we've put on black or canvas, and come with some questions, but not just what's the answer, right? Work it out. We're going to work it out. And so it's more or less going to be like a class participation trying to work out some of those problems, but guided help. Okay, is that good? So I know it messes up your weekend, but if you get ready for that, then you're not cramming Wednesday night all night long and coming in delirious on Thursday. All right? And Thursday's exam is mostly multiple choice because we only have the hour and 15 minutes or so. And you know, maybe a few open response questions, but very short, you know, just real simple ones. And as in the other ones, we've always had more points than just 100%. So this is your bonus point. So you could make more than 100%, just like on the last exam. Okay. Questions on that part? Are we good? All right. So some questions that came about over the last couple of days have been on the chart with the reproductive cycle, and I know it's a little confusing sometimes, but I think what would help is I made a little flow chart, so this might help a little bit, but it's very logical in the sense of negative feedback processes, and I think if we go through these figures, let's just recap a little bit of this to make it a little bit easier. I wrote some things out, so I think it might be easier to start with the follicle and the FSH. So if you think of FSH increasing, start with that. That might be the easiest. And follicle development. So FSH is follicle stimulating hormone, right? So it's going to start to proliferate the follicle, develop the ovarian follicle. And then you see that LH is going up as well, right? Can you see that?
Yes.
LH is going up as well. And then you think about, what does LH do? Well, that's the luteinizing hormone. And remember, luteinizing hormone, corpus luteum. What's the corpus luteum do? Releases hormones. It actually increases the synthesis and secretes some androgens. But that follicle-stimulating hormone actually activates the enzymes, and it actually increases estrogen as well. So estrogen goes up. What's this estrogen going to do? It's going to go back to the hypothalamus in the anterior pituitary, and that can actually cause a little bit of a surge. It's actually sometimes used in textbooks, and I don't know which textbook you might be looking at, but somewhat of a positive feedback. And this is where it gets confusing, because some people looked at other texts, and there is this short positive feedback at low levels, so it can actually increase FSH and increase LH, and that positive feedback causes a more of a surge on this. The follicle-stimulating hormone causes the maturation of that developing follicle, and then that surge in the LH really causes a rupture of the follicle. And then you enter what we call, remember, the luteal phase. So when you get ovulation, that's the luteal phase. And this is all, even this positive feedback up here, this hypothalamus anterior pituitary, that's increasing the growth of the endometrium. So you're seeing this endometrium growth here. And remember, what this growth is maintained by hormones too, like coming out of the early corpus luteum, where estrogen's coming out of here, and that's helping to maintain this growth of the endometrial lining. And I know it's a little confusing, but then we get to the corpus luteum, and it secretes progesterone at this level. That progesterone, that higher progesterone, can go back and actually be the negative feedback for the gonadotropin releasing hormone. Remember, where does that come from? Anybody?
Hypothalamus.
So then that's going to the anterior pituitary, and if you have less of it, then you're decreasing your FSH and LH out of your anterior pituitary. So it can be a little confusing, but I think if we go through step by step, it might help. In that figure we gave in the class last time, it had a temperature rise with that too, so that might be helpful for some of you to think about. Where that temperature starts to rise and stays high until menses occurs. Clear as mud? Yes. Okay. I know it's a bit much, but hopefully not too bad. And everything's posted on here on your webpage, both that endocrine content we went over and your endocrine, the clinical endocrine that we covered, you know, on some of those main human disorders. And I mentioned it before, and people got emails, but they probably didn't listen to the echo, was that you don't have to know all those drugs that are on there, right? We don't have to know any of those drugs. That's too much. But the idea is that you can block with antagonists. You can block surges of, say, some hormone that's working on a receptor. They can use drugs to block those receptors to try to depress the activity. And you can actually... if you're not making enough, use synthetic hormones, right? That's what was in a lot of, that was one of the questions on an email. Why are you giving that drug? Because that's a synthetic hormone that acts like that. If you're not making T3, T4, for example, the question was about Synthroid. Why give Synthroid? Well, that Synthroid is a synthetic thyroid hormone, and it acts on those same receptors. So it's like an agonist. Okay, does that help with the hormones somewhat? Yes?
You said that the corpus luteum secretes GnRH?
No. That goes back and inhibits it secretes progesterone. Okay. And that goes back, that high progesterone goes back and inhibits the GnRH. So that's the negative feedback that happens from the corpus luteum. So that corpus luteum, high progesterone, that high level will go back and suppress, keeps it suppressed for making any more FSH and LH. I know it's a little bit much, but we're not trying to confuse you. We're trying to make it sensible. Okay, so now let's go to this next chapter. So I know there's a lot on endocrine. I'm well aware of that. And that's why we're trying to have quizzes and keep you up to date. So we're on to a new chapter, really, now. And we're on to circulatory system. And it's really cool. Oh, I forgot to do something. I was going to show you this cockroach, too. This is really cool. I caught this the other day. I'll just put it over here. Where did it go to? Here it is. This was crawling around on the floors in the biology building. I know, it's nasty. But isn't that cool? Okay. So, I don't know if you can see it. I can zoom in maybe here. Let's see if I can zoom in. Let's see if this works. Zoom. Whoa, that thing's monstrous. Oh my God, it's like a giant. Isn't that nasty? Okay, so we used to have labs at one time. In some physiology classes, you actually use cockroach labs. It's not like the neuro techniques course where you're using that hissing cockroach. But the cockroach has these really neat little... let me see if I can get it turned upside down so you can still see it. Oh, yeah, there you go. You see these little things here? These little processes that come off the back? They're called cerci. And those have the fine little hairs on them. So when you go to try to step on the cockroach, that's what it picks up, that wind vibration, and it goes the other direction. You can actually pop the head off, too, like with this little string, and it can still run around and avoid you stepping on it because of those little cerci. So a lot of people have studied that because, just to kind of refresh your memory, it's kind of neat, is that it grows with the animal. And those hairs grow as the cerci grows. So it's adding new hairs. And then think about that. It's the stage, and it has to put those neurons into a functional CNS to be able to move quickly. So that's pretty neat that it can continually add new sensory neurons, and the sensory cell bodies are out towards the hair base. So it's growing into the intact CNS and mixing in with that neural circuit. That's pretty cool. And then those little hairs on the legs are really neat too, because those are mechanosensory. If you touch them, they'll fire. The neurons will fire. I know it's kind of gross to see it, but anyways, a lot of labs actually use some of the hissing cockroach or these cockroaches and record from the sensory nerves. But a lot of research has gone on in the development of these sensory neurons projecting into the CNS for what? Regeneration and repair. Just to kind of let you think about it. It's not just a comparative basis, but actually to try to understand functional mechanisms. And remember that cockroach, the neuromuscular junctions are glutaminergic. The sensory neurons that go into the CNS are cholinergic. So you're... Insecticides work on altering the sensory input into the CNS, which then work at your neuromuscular junctions, too, to try to inhibit synaptic transmission. Okay, so, whoops, that thing's gone crazy. Okay, so we're going to start the circulatory system. And I think this is on your webpage somewhere that you can download. You don't have to download it, but it's just kind of a fun thing to look at too. But let's just talk about the circulatory system. Why do we need a circulatory system? Anybody? To get caffeine to our body. Substances, right? Yeah. And so let's just think about what are all those substances. Good. So, like we just covered, like you said, hormones, right? That's the whole endocrine response. Nutrients, oxygen, and we're talking about getting stuff to the tissues. What about waste products, right? CO2, we want to get the waste out too, right? We need to get the waste out as well. Oh, did you see that on CNN? Oh, shoot, I should try to pull that up. Let's see if I can do that. It's just so wild. Let's see if I can get to this. Whoops, crap. CNN News. Oh, there's a part that was really quite interesting, and it relates to what we've talked about, besides all the other crap that's in the news these days. But it was down here somewhere. About how to get rid of fat.
Breathe.
Oh, here it is. So this is on CNN that came in the other day. It says, where does fat go when you lose weight? So they interviewed a whole bunch of physicians, healthcare workers.
I read it.
And what was the outcome of this?
Exhale.
Pardon?
You exhale if you're in your home.
Yeah, but what is it exhaled as?
CO2.
CO2, and what else as the end of that tattoo that everybody should have, right? Water, right? C6H2. C6H12O6, right? Plus oxygen, six oxygens. Gives the final product is what? Water and CO2, right? And so you should, you know, that's a great tattoo to get besides neuron tattoos. But they went ahead and interviewed a bunch of healthcare physicians, and they thought, you know, it's converted to energy, it's converted to muscle. 98% of health physicians, professionals, didn't get that right. Makes you think about what did they take? Did they take biochemistry? Now we know why biochem's so important, right? But the point is, you want to know these things so you don't seem crazy. All right, especially that you had an animal phys course and you've got some of this content down. All right, so kind of neat to think about. Metabolism, we lose weight through all that, converted to water and CO2. And we talked about even how plants grow, right? Basically, that weight of the tree is carbon and oxygen from the air, right? So, getting rid of that CO2, like you're mentioning, you know, waste products, that's a circulatory system, hormones, nutrients. But what about, why do we have such an advanced circulatory system? Why can't we just use a hemolymph, just bathe our tissues around it like an insect? For example, why do we have to have a circulatory system?
We're too big.
We're too big. The tissue's too thick, right? So in some animals, if you go through the animal and you look at simple animals to more complex animals, bigger mass animals, you will see that development of the circulatory system matching very well. Simple animals like a planaria, by diffusion. You don't need a circulatory system to move the blood around, because just by diffusion you can get oxygen in, CO2 out, right? The nutrients can go into that hemolymph can spread over the tissue, and basically all the tissue is exposed to the nutrients, and then can be washed out through the back through the hemolymph, all right? And as you get to more complex animals, then you begin to see development of arterioles, capillary beds, and getting down to that deep tissue, right? Much like, think about other aspects. So structure function is really important in physiology. Think about what we talked about on skeletal muscle. Kind of a review here. T-tubules, right? What is a T-tubule? The skeletal muscle, T-tubule, is that invagination of the plasma membrane. But in animals like a Drosophila larvae, it's just a single muscle fiber. Does it really need a T-tubule to go deep in the muscle? No. So you don't see T-tubules in those animals, right? But as you get in animals with thicker muscle, you need to get those T-tubules in there so you can have that depolarization down deep and get calcium to be released from internal stores. And that calcium can be close to the contractile elements. But in like a Drosophila muscle or some insect muscles, the calcium really comes across the plasma membrane. That's different than us. Remember, our calcium in our skeletal muscle comes from sarcoplasmic reticulum. But in some insects, many insects, and crustaceans, the calcium comes across the cell membrane through voltage-gated calcium channels, and it's not so much from internal release because it's not that thick. All right. So structure function, you should always be thinking of structure function. It's really quite interesting to think about. Angiogenesis is a really big factor, development of a circulatory system in cancer therapy. Because when cancers are growing quickly, what do they need? Oxygen, right? They need that blood. So some of the treatments are to stop angiogenesis so the tumors cannot grow. But what does that do to other systems in your body that you need a circulatory system that always is changing around? I mean, you're always kind of developing new capillary beds and pulling them back. This is why people that exercise if they have a heart attack, they're usually much better survival rate because they're exercising their heart and they get an increased vascularization. So if some part clogs up, because if you have that increased vascularization, you're less likely to have the problem of killing out all the tissue. And even if you did have a heart attack, they will suggest you to start to exercise slowly to increase that vascularization and to try to regain. But you're not going to come back so well from that dead heart tissue, right? It doesn't really regenerate that well, but it's to help you from having any more problems. Pretty neat. You've probably heard of people having vascular... what's that called again? Where your veins are enlarged, like in your legs. Yeah. You know, and ladies like to get those removed sometimes, right? Because they don't like the big blood vessels on their legs. So they take those out, but they might ask you to actually exercise ahead of time to try to increase your vascularization. So when they remove that, then you already have vascularization in other ways. And they take that away, it might be some time, but then you'll have deeper vascularization to the muscle and to the tissue, and they might take away those varicose veins. That's the word I was looking for. And that's kind of neat, too. Any other cases where they might take out a vein from a leg for some other use? What are you thinking about?
Surgeries.
Like what type of surgery?
Pardon? Heart surgery,
like a coronary bypass, right? So you might have heard of people, and they might show you the scars on their calves or the front of their leg, where they've actually taken away that blood vessel to use for a coronary bypass, where the coronary artery clogs up. They take that out and they bypass it with your own blood vessels. That's pretty cool to think about, too. I had a heart over there in the outreach center that had coronary bypass, and I forgot to bring it out. They actually had a triple bypass. That would have been really cool because you could see all the blood vessels that went, you know, where they bypassed the problems. So it's really neat to think about what people have been able to do with the circulatory system for health and care, but also for treatments like with cancer to try to stop blood vessels from growing and then work on cancer therapy. Pretty neat. Okay, so if we think about circulatory system, like you mentioned, oxygen carrying, nutrient carrying, and how do we carry oxygen?
Hemoglobin,
right? So we need the red blood cell for the hemoglobin. Now we're going to talk about ion transport a little bit later with hemoglobin and everything, but let's just cover that now. So in mammals or invertebrates, we use hemoglobin as the respiratory pigment, binds oxygen, you know, four oxygen binding spots. It's a cooperativity for binding of oxygen. We talked a little bit about it, I think, when we were talking about myoglobin for skeletal muscle. In your skeletal muscle, you have myoglobin. It's a singular globular unit of oxygen binding capacity, right? And hemoglobin is what? Four. And it's a quaternary structure. It's kind of a review again. Well, so, and you need the hemoglobin to bind the oxygen in your red blood cell. But if you get that red blood cell down to your skeletal muscle, you need that hemoglobin to come off, right? So how do you get oxygen off of the hemoglobin? Pardon? That's part of it, kind of. But right at your skeletal muscle, you're exercising, you need that oxygen to go in to get to your mitochondria to make ATP. Myoglobin binds oxygen with greater affinity, so it's like a sink. It's going to pull it on over into the skeletal muscle. But what else is happening to exercise in the skeletal muscle? What happens if you exercise? Does your temperature change? Increased temperature decreases oxygen binding affinity. So now the oxygen can come off it, right? What else are you producing as a byproduct in your exercising skeletal muscle?
Lactic
acid,
CO2,
and what does CO2 do to pH?
It lowers it.
So now it's a more acidic environment. Your oxygen binding to hemoglobin decreases in an acidic environment. So that's pretty cool. Your hemoglobin, the red blood cell, goes down to your skeletal muscle and into the capillary bed. Higher temperature, lower pH due to lactic acid and CO2 rising, which drops the pH. But you have buffers in there too, right? That causes the oxygen to come off, has a lower affinity. But then you have myoglobin in your skeletal muscle, so it pulls it into your skeletal muscle. And then that hemoglobin goes around. And hemoglobin itself can be a buffer for hydrogen ion. There's actually binding sites on hemoglobin, so it can buffer the pH, the low pH. And then you think about it, goes around and comes back to the capillary bed in your lungs. And I know we're not talking about respiratory yet, but it's combined with circulatory. So what happens in your lungs? You're blowing off CO2. What happens to the pH? It goes up. It's generally cooler than, say, exercising skeletal muscle. So now the temperature drops. So what have we done to binding oxygen binding affinity? Increased it. And so you see, it all kind of makes sense. It's all circulating around. So kind of think about these things when we're thinking about the circulatory system as well as the respiratory system, and then thinking about, like what we were talking about, delivering nutrients or waste products to the different tissues to get rid of them. Pretty neat. So we've mentioned a few things already, but this little chapter, if you want to read it, I think it's as a PDF online, but you don't have to. The main points I want to talk about here is that they found these bloodless fish. So fish normally make hemoglobin. And fish normally have a circulatory system, a closed circulatory system like us. So down by the Falkland Islands, which is in South Atlantic Ocean, down by the Antarctic, right? And they found these bloodless fish, and it's really quite neat. Anybody read this in your evolution class? Did they cover bloodless fish in evolution class? No? Yes? Maybe? Forgot? Okay. These are really quite neat because they have a circulatory system, but their blood vessels are larger. Their capillary beds are larger. And they have no red blood cells. Well, no red blood cells, and they don't even make hemoglobin. How on earth are they getting oxygen to their tissues? Ideas?
Lymph.
Pardon?
Lymph.
Lymph. An idea with lymph. So they don't have red blood cells. They don't even have hemoglobin. If you look at their genome, they actually have genes that are in there to make hemoglobin and red blood cells, but they're defective. They're missing parts. So evolutionarily, they probably did it one time, and then they had a mutation and probably evolved out. But because of their environment, hint, hint, they're able to survive. What's so unique about their environment? Antarctic. Penguins. It's cold. So what's so unique about cold aspects? Like with solutions. Back to chemistry.
Oxygen gas is more soluble in solutions.
Exactly. Oxygen and the gases are more soluble in cold solution. And they have a bigger capillary bed, so they're getting more fluid to the tissues. But because they're in such cold environment, they can actually dissolve more oxygen and just carry it in their blood. But they're not really big fish. They're relatively small fish, too. So this is kind of neat to think about. It's a really neat aspect. And when they first collected them and brought them up to the surface and then put them into regular tanks, most of them died because it wasn't at the same cold temperature. So pretty neat. You might see these sometimes in some aquarium, but they're going to be very cold aquarium, almost, you know, like... And you know that seawater can go to -4 degrees centigrade without freezing because of the salt. So you can have very cold seawater below the freezing of fresh water, and that helps hold oxygen. Okay, so that's kind of neat. This is a nice little article. And when we get into respiratory, which we'll do later, we'll talk a little bit more about things. Okay, so let's go through the circulatory system and just get some terms out of the way. Hemolymph, as we mentioned, open circulatory system through the hemoceal, that's why they call hemolymph, and like a grasshopper, Drosophila, you have an open body cavity. It's called a hemoceal. So hemolymph is the equivalent of the blood in these open circulatory systems. Now, what gets confusing is that there are people in on tests, and sometimes these standardized tests you see online, it can be confusing because they have, open circulatory system has no capillary beds. Is that true or false? This is where it gets confusing, so that's why I bring it up. In open circulatory systems, you can have capillary beds. In particular, like the gills of a crayfish, for example, your favorite animal. They actually have arteries that perfuse blood to the gills, and in the gills, they're very fine blood vessels, like a capillary, right? Takes in oxygen, gets rid of CO2, and then that circulates back into the body circulatory system, and then goes back to the heart, and then can be pumped around. But like in the crayfish, the blood vessels at the end of their legs are just open endings. So it just pushes blood down into the leg, but where is it going to go? If it just has an open ending, it's just going to go to the leg, but it's not an open hole out to the environment, right? So that open body cavity around the muscles, then it comes back into the body thorax. And then in the heart, there's little holes in the heart. And the blood can go into those little holes, and the heart contracts, it closes those holes and pushes it out the arteries. What's really interesting is even a crayfish or a crab can direct blood flow. People have actually put little detectors on arteries, arterioles, in crustaceans, and show that after they have a meal, they'll increase blood flow to the stomach, to the intestines. And when they're exercising, that gets shut down, and more blood flow out to the skeletal muscle, to the limbs. So they even have regulatory in how to direct blood flow in an open circulatory system. So that's kind of neat to think about, right? Because then that means finer regulation. Now you can think about more complex animals in a closed circulatory system and just advancing that same kind of regulation. Okay, so closed systems, as we mentioned, it's like us, you know, the blood circulates all the way around, right? And capillaries, and now this is where I just mentioned, can be confusing, right? Because you can have capillary beds like in the gill chamber. All right. So these kind of pictures, generally, you know, you think about the insects, and there's some really interesting circulatory systems in annelids and worms because they can have multiple pumps. They can have this blood vessel can actually pump and keep blood going one direction, and it can actually come back and change the direction of blood flow and actually pump backwards. Leeches do that, and I should have brought in a leech. You could see that. It's really quite neat. If you ever get an earthworm, with all this rain coming around, you can pin it out and actually just cut down the backside, and you can actually see the blood vessels. You'll see the red blood. They have actually red blood. And you can see it pumping, and then come back and pump and come back. It's kind of neat. You can put different drugs on and see if it changes it, for example. Really kind of neat system. But the idea is simpler systems, and you get to more complex systems and capillary beds. So you don't have to memorize, you know, all the little parts here that they have so many hearts. But here, each one of these can actually pump. So it's like its own little heart for its segment. Isn't that interesting? I mean, so it can keep blood flowing. But also in these animals, like annelids, the movement of the animal helps to move that fluid around. Just like you, if you stand still too long, right, you're on a plane ride, what happens to your feet? They swell up, right? And that's a problem, because why is that a problem if blood stays still? It can clot. And if anybody work in the airline industry, stewardess, whatever you call people nowadays in the airline industry, they're actually trained on the long-term flights, the real long one that they now started like from England to Australia, right? They actually train them to exercise people, right? And there's even things that come up on the TV so you would remember to do that, like move your feet around or walk around. And sometimes when people get up after these long flights, that's when they just fall over flat down. What happened? The blood clot went to their lungs, blocked their lungs, and they died right there. Right? Sometimes people in an ICU unit in the hospital that have been bedridden for a long time or maybe in a coma, they try to move them, like move them in the bed, change the bed sheets, give them a bath, and all of a sudden they die. What happened? A blood clot dislodged and went right to their lungs and killed them. And that happens. If any of you are nurses or something and you're actually taking care of patients, that might happen to you. It's going to be traumatic, but it could happen to you, right? So that can happen with people in the hospital. That's why they put those things around the legs, the pneumatic things that keep the blood moving around. So those are important. People don't like to use them, but you can see the reason for it. So kind of putting this into real-life perspective helps as well, I think. Okay, so you want to keep that blood moving around, not to let it stay still too long. All right, so we can kind of cruise through this. Oh, just to kind of remind you, I talked about the crayfish heart. It has three pairs of holes on the heart, and blood can go in there. And then when it contracts, it closes those holes and pushes blood down the arteriole. And like insects, it depends on the insect, but the general point is they also have holes in their heart that the blood can go in. So when it contracts, it closes that hole and then pushes blood a particular direction. It's kind of neat, these little ostia that are open holes in the heart and allow the blood to then pump. So you see the hemocoel in there, and then
the direction of blood flow.
Okay. So we can kind of cruise through that. And there's a lot in circulatory, but we'll just, you know, hit the main points. So some of the main points, too, to think about, and I know we're going to come back to this as we go through the whole chapter, but you might have taken your hematocrit, for example, in your, while we're talking about red blood cells, that's the percentage of red blood cells compared to the rest of your blood. So if you took a, you know, poked your finger, pulled your blood up into a capillary. We used to be able to do these in high schools and middle schools, but now with all the blood-borne diseases, people don't do this anymore. But it used to be a fun thing, and we used to actually do these in physiology labs. So you can poke your finger, put your blood into a little capillary tube, put wax in the end, put it on a centrifuge that has little lines in it, and put it little capillaries, and then you spin it. Spins around, and then you take your capillary, and you put it on a little card, and you rotate that card around to where the 100% mark is, and then you can read how many red blood cells are the percent of red blood cells to your total blood that you've taken out. That's your hematocrit. So it's the percent of red blood cells to the total blood that's taken out. It's kind of neat to think about. Males usually have a bit more, and females have a bit less. Why might you have low hematocrit if we're going back to thinking of the endocrine chapter? What might be a reason that you would have low hematocrit? Review. It's an important question. Hint, hint. Hydration. What else?
Kidneys. And then,
kidneys. Poietin something. Anybody help her out? Erythropoietin, right? And it comes from where?
The kidneys.
Kidneys and? You said it.
Right.
And? The other tissue you said? Liver, right? Kidneys and liver. So if you had kidney problems, or you had maybe some aspects, you're going to have lower erythropoietin. Erythropoietin goes to your bones, long bones, stimulates the bone marrow to make RBCs, right? So if you have kidney problems, you might not have the erythropoietin, but also liver is actually adding to this as well. So cirrhosis of the liver can decrease that level also. You think about people with multiple organ problems, like liver and kidneys, right? Erythropoietin is going down, so you could have low hematocrit. So, interesting to check relatively easily. Okay, and then the plasma is the other solution that's above that red blood cells, and it contains a lot of the water, but also proteins, lipoproteins, right, triglycerides, and, you know, that all the other factors that are in there that we'll talk a little bit about, but not too much about. So that hematocrit, right, the RBCs, the fluffy coat, the white blood cells, and then plasma, 55%, and if that was 45%, then you think about the rest of it, plasma. You go to the Kentucky Blood Center and donate plasma, and why would they, and then they, you can donate your plasma, and then they give you back your RBCs. Why do they do that? Anybody? They, once you do it, they keep calling you too because they know every 14 days you can actually donate plasma again. Whereas your RBCs, what's the lifespan of an RBC? The MCAT type of question.
68.
RBC is 45 days. How about longer than that? Do we know?
I work in a plasma donation center, and the donors can come back.
For the plasma. Now for the RBCs, whole blood, how often can they come back?
The donor actually gets a return to them in the process.
Yeah, so if you wanted to donate whole blood itself, not just the plasma, but you wanted to donate whole blood, how often?
Yeah,
120 days for your RBCs in a human, right? Your life's 120 days. So this is what they check with glucose. If you're anybody that you know is a diabetic, they check A1C, the glucose that binds to hemoglobin, glycosylated hemoglobin, because it can tell what your glucose level was over 120 days, basically, right? So that's why they measure A1C in diabetics. They want to see if you actually regulated your glucose over the last 120 days, because your RBCs stay around for about 120 days. So it gives you a window over that last 120 days of what your glucose levels were. Yes?
Question. Did you say why there are less hematocrit in females?
Why there's a lower hematocrit?
Yeah.
So why is there probably a lower hematocrit generally in females? Menses too, right? The periods that go on. So some females are, you know, suggested to take this different vitamins, which has more iron. Why more iron? Because iron is utilized in hemoglobin, right? That's that iron molecule that's inside hemoglobin. So that's generally part of it, right? And we have... and so what might be another reason low hematocrit, if we go to the point about your red blood cells are made in your long bones. What are long bones? Long bones in your ribs, right? So let's say you had a car accident. You smashed your ribs on the steering wheel, and they're damaged, and they're bruised, and they're not getting good circulation. What could happen to hematocrit? It could drop, too. So this is why they watch those things, right? So it's kind of neat to think about all these aspects. So a long time ago, people used to bleed people when they were sick. And it's kind of interesting, so you can read, you know, textbooks that go through the history. And the problem is, when you're sick, what do you make? Like if you have an infection?
White blood cells.
White blood cells. Or leukocytes, right? So what's going to happen to the buffy coat here? It's going to increase. So if you took blood from sick people and healthy people, and you put it into these kind of glass tubes, and you, old days, they could spin it around like a, you know, by hand, right? And they might even do that still in some places. Spin it around by hand, and you can actually separate out the blood, and you can see that the buffy coat is bigger in sick people. So what would you think? It must be the cause of the sickness, right? So what do? Bleed them. And that's where a lot of the bleeding therapies came from. And so they would use leeches. You know, like the leech I brought in here that day? They would put them on people. Napoleon actually would advocate for his soldiers that were sick, another 200 leeches on that person. Can you imagine? Psychologically, you might just say, I'm not sick anymore because you don't want leeches on you. But they actually would put leeches, up to 100 or 200 leeches on a person to try to decrease the sickness from them and get rid of the bad things that were causing their sickness, they thought. But we know better now, right? So they probably just did more harm than good. Or maybe it stimulated to make more red blood cells or their immune system to kick in by having leeches on. Who knows? So it's kind of interesting, especially if you go in the history of the cardiovascular system. So your spleen is very important to get rid of old red blood cells. The spleen is really important for this. But not only that, it stores healthy erythrocytes, red blood cells, platelets, which are important for blood clotting, and a key factor, lymphocytes. Lymphocytes, very important. What are those? White blood cells, right? Okay, so an interesting case just to think about, and she actually is open about it, a person, a faculty member, she actually wrote an article in the Louisville Courier. The New York Times picked it up. It went on AP Press, and it actually kind of upset of people at the UK hospital a bit. So her husband was sick, and so she took her husband to the urgent care center south of town, down by Nicholsville, and they said, oh, he's got a flu. Well, he said, well, he did get this little dog bite from, you know, a little tiny little dog that was in the neighborhood. He's a jogger, and he's a biker, and he's super healthy. This guy would just ride down to Somerset for the weekend and ride back on his bicycle. Tells you how healthy he is, okay? So he's a bike rider, go 150 miles just on a weekend for the fun of it. And really healthy. But this, when he was jogging in the neighborhood, this little toy poodle thing bit him because they were visiting, some friends were visiting in the next-door neighbor's house. He didn't think much about it because it was a tiny little bite. But 2 days later, he's feeling sick. You're kind of getting the scenario. Goes to the urgent care center to tell him he has a flu. Okay, back home, sleep it off. The next day, he feels worse. His wife takes him to the UK ER. They say, he waited there 5 hours. But they also said, they think it's just the flu. Send him back home. He's really kind of getting sick. So the wife takes him back to the UK ER. They said, we don't really think he has much more. He's got really bad flu. They took a blood sample, didn't really do much about it, but they took it, didn't report anything to the family, and then they went back home. But the next day, he could barely move out of the bed. So she came back to the ER, dropped him off at the hospital. This is all written up in AP Press. And she went to go park her car across the street. He was already in a coma by the time she got back. She was in a coma for 54 days. The health records are all there. She told them they had a dog bite. They said it probably didn't have any effect on this. It's just a tiny little bite. Excuse me, how big is a bacteria? Right? How big is a bacteria? Pretty small. A little dog bite can do it, right? People bites are really bad too. But dogs carry gram-negative bacteria. Gram-negative bacteria is very bad. Most of the time you have a lot of gram-positive bacteria. So they then checked his blood and found out his white blood cell count was a problem. And they didn't have the white blood cells that he should have had. But then they started to treat him with antibiotics because they thought he had some sepsis, bacterial infection in your blood. But they were giving him a mixture of drugs that weren't going to touch the gram-negative bacteria at all. So, but the dog still there said it probably had nothing to do with the dog bite. But in his records, in his health records, guess what was in there? He was asplenic. Asplenic without a spleen. That's like a red flag. A big red flag waving, slapping in the head. You know, it's like that heartburn commercial. Because anybody that doesn't have a spleen has a big problem. They don't have the white blood cell count to go up to fight the infection. So then once they found that, they realized, uh-oh, big problem. So in the write-up, I'll send it to you, we ran with her and gave her about 50 articles that showed dog bites with gram-negative bacteria that is really a problem and that it can cause these kind of issues. So anyways, they changed the antibiotics because they were treating with the wrong antibiotics. And finally, they could start to decrease the bacteria. But because he was with this bacteria, what happens is your blood will start to clot. And then what happens is blood clots. That's a problem, right? But then it clots so much that you take away all your clotting factors, like your platelets, and then what happens? You start bleeding because you have no clotting factors left. Because the bacteria, it tries to fight it. So all those clotting factors went away, and now little bruises or little breaks, like in your intestines and other things, you start to bleed out. Well, anyways, he lost some fingers and toes, lost his hearing, 54 days in a coma, and then finally he was coming out. The docs gave him about 20% survival. And so really bad, just a little dog bite, gram-negative bacteria, without a spleen, all big problems. But gram-negative bacteria is common in dog bites. Anyways, every dog bite that's ever given, if you go to the doctor or something, is supposed to be reported to your health department, actually, so they can actually follow up on the dog and make sure, see what's happening. But most dogs and animals will carry gram-negative bacteria. Human bites are bad, too. So anyway, that kind of lets you think about all the systems that go together, and it's kind of neat to think about. Okay, so we talked about hemopoietic tissues, red bone marrow. I'll send you that AP article so you can read it. For making red blood cells. And erythropoietin, like we talked about, from the liver and kidneys. Kidneys primarily, but also the liver to make red blood cells. And your red blood cells don't have a nucleus. In some animals, that actually keep the nucleus in the red blood cell. Isn't that wild? But in us, that nucleus goes away in your red blood cell, so you don't, it doesn't have a nucleus. But why do we even need red blood cells? For the hemoglobin, right? But why not just have hemoglobin out in the blood? Why do we need to put it in a red blood cell? Why do you think that would be? Why do we need it in a red blood cell? Why can't we just have hemoglobin as a protein just floating around in the blood? Well, yes, that's key. And there's a particular enzyme that's really important in the red blood cell, which is CA, carbonic anhydrase, which can convert the CO2, the bicarb, and hydrogen ion at a million fold faster than without it. So that's right next to the RBC, inside the RBC, which is right next to hemoglobin, which helps with that whole pH regulation and also buffering, because hemoglobin itself can be a buffer, as I mentioned. So if you have that enzyme close by, a nice package, then it's actually helping to bind oxygen to hemoglobin, but also disassociation. So the red blood cell is important for keeping all that all together, like you mentioned. Okay, neat to think about. All right, so, you know, the general idea, long bones for in your ribs for making RBCs in the kidney and the liver for erythropoietin. Platelets, like we mentioned already, very important for blood clotting, and this is really neat. We'll go through, I know there's a lot on here, but I think this next figure will help in the major understanding of these. Okay, and that these come from these megakaryocytes in the bone marrow. So this figure is kind of interesting because it pulls it all together and it makes you realize it's really quite amazing. And if we can work with more stem cells, that could help with many of these factors too, and maybe even help with some of the people that aren't making white blood cells well. But it all comes from the stem cell, this undifferentiated stem cell that's in your bone marrow. Then these myeloid stem cells can actually be converted into these different aspects, like a megakaryocyte, granulocytes, or erythrocyte that then makes red blood cells. So erythrocytes are the same term as RBCs. Granulocytes important because these are your neutrophils, eosinophils, and basophils, and we'll talk more about those a little bit later. But these are really important for making platelets for blood clotting factors. All right, so platelets. These are like fragments inside of your blood. The lymphoid stem cell, so lymphoid, lymph, think about lymph with lymphocytes. All right, they can then stimulate the lymph glands, right? You're like your tonsils are lymph glands, right? Your tonsils. Anybody get a tonsillectomy? I had one before. Why did you get a tonsillectomy if you don't mind sharing? Mine is because I kept having infection that would swell up and cause like sore throat all the time. Right? Same old thing. So it used to be a big fad, especially when I was like in high school. Everybody got like their tonsils taken out. But then they kind of realized, maybe that's not such a good thing anymore. So they actually are more careful with that now. Medicine really changes 180 degrees sometimes, right? And so now they realize, hey, that's not maybe the best thing because why? They're making white blood cells to help fight the infection. So sometimes in the other lymph glands, like under your armpits and places, will actually swell up if you get the tonsillectomy because you're not making white blood cells. All right, so lymphocytes from the lymph tissue to help you make lymphocytes to then fight blood cells to fight foreign bodies, right? Great course to take, immunology, if you ever take that. So let's just, I'm not going to read through every part here. I'm just going to go to this factor. And I don't want you to memorize all of this, but there's some key elements that even appeared on standardized exams before. So with some of this you want to know. So basically, you have a whole bunch of cascades. What I want you to know is you have a whole bunch of cascades that help in your blood clot. All right? And these are important for you. Let's say you're just walking across campus. You probably damaged some capillary beds. You hit your leg on the side of the chair. You damaged your tissue. Well, if you didn't clot those little capillaries, then you're going to have a big old bruise, and it's going to bleed even more, right? So you're clotting all the time, and then you're breaking down those clots all the time. It's always going on in your body, all the time, making them, breaking them down, making them, breaking them down. So your body does this to help keep your circulatory system intact. And so these factors, like a damaged blood vessel, will stimulate these processes. So a damaged blood vessel can stimulate these clotting factors. Now, you don't have to know all these parts, but there's what's called an extrinsic pathway and an intrinsic pathway. And this intrinsic pathway is usually from damaged tissue or some foreign substance, okay? Like putting blood on it or putting something in your body, for example. All right, so it goes to these factors. Calcium is important, so here's the key elements. Calcium is important in this process. And then when you get into this level of the extrinsic pathway, you see every time making an inactive to an active form, inactive to an active form. But here's the key spots that's usually on standardized exam. Prothrombin is activated by like factor 5, calcium, and it makes thrombin. And thrombin is really important. Because thrombin is what converts fibrinogen to fibrin, and that's that mesh network that we think of with the blood clot. Thrombin also activates this factor called 13, X123, you know, so that's factor 13, and that makes that fibrin into a stronger network mesh that can then block that leakage, for example. And then you get that clot. So usually what you see on standardized exams is prothrombin to thrombin, and then thrombin converting fibrinogen to fibrin, but also making that network more complex that then blocks that, say, damaged blood vessel. Alright? Hemophiliacs? What's a hemophiliac? Pardon?
Free bleeder.
A bleeder, right? That can't, a little bruise, a little hit on them, they continue to bleed out. So when you're donating to the Kentucky Blood Center, and that's where I was going with that tangent, they might just take out your plasma and give you back your RBCs. They take a whole bunch of blood out, goes through this machine, spins it around, and then comes back your RBCs. This way you can donate more often, but the RBCs come back to keep your oxygen RBCs going, but you make your platelets very quickly. And so you can turn over your platelets fast. They're taking the platelets out to potentially give to people that are hemophiliacs. And those hemophiliacs then get the plasma injected into them that helps them with their clotting mechanism, right? And if you take in genetics, you probably saw some of the genetic linkage. Did they ever do that with the hemophiliac, with the royalty in England, right? And that it's a genetic link. What is it? Females are carriers. Guys generally get it, right? And so people can do the genetic testing and look at that. So that's really interesting, and that's why the hemophiliacs were kind of the first people in the U.S. that were getting AIDS, because people that were donating blood or plasma, they were getting the high levels of plasma injected in. So a lot of the hemophiliacs all came down with AIDS early on because they weren't testing the blood, and that they got the AIDS from the plasma. So this is how the hemophiliacs got in here. They weren't doing other things. It was actually from the plasma that they were getting. So kind of interesting to put it all in perspective. Okay, we're going to have to stop for a quiz here in a minute. So some of these figures, just kind of go through this. And like we said, this multi-pastor thrombin is really important. And so hemophiliacs, let's just finish that off. There's different types of hemophiliacs. Some hemophiliacs don't make some of these factors, like maybe factor 13, are a different factor. So they'll actually break down the type of hemophiliac, and usually it has to do with one of these factors. So there's different forms of hemophilia based on these different factors that might be missing. Some people don't make this Hagman factor, and they actually have to get that injection or get that taken care of by having it. And when they get that, that blood that they're getting with the Hagman factor is very expensive. They can have $1,200 per infusion to get that. It's very expensive for some of these people to maintain their life, actually, throughout. So your insurance, hopefully. Okay, so we will stop with the planaria. All right. Exactly. I'm a little bit behind, but you know how it goes. That's me. Okay.